We dedicate this podcast to the memory of Dr. Michael Conroy. Mike passed away in July 2025, and the world lost one of its foremost biometricians. We thank Mike for his vast contributions to wildlife management, but more so for his humor, kindness, and generosity. Much of our quantitative thinking comes from Mike's ideas and writing. Our sincerest condolences to his family and friends. This is Wildlife by the Numbers, a podcast about wildlife ecology focused on the proper and robust design of studies concerned with the conservation and management of fish and wildlife. We hope to entertain and enlighten young and aspiring wildlife ecologists, along with seasoned professionals. Our wish is to help guide the application of science and conservation. This is Grant Harris,
Matt Butler,
David Stewart.
Thanks for joining. Last time we were talking about precision and accuracy and variability, and we're getting deep into it. We're going to stay deep into it on this podcast, and today we're going to continue on this discussion of precision and variability and accuracy. Randy or Matt, do you want to dive in before I continue?
I would start with is how much change is important to you and is going to trigger your management actions, your management activities. And then we go from there to get that, well, how precise of an estimate do we need? How much survey effort do we need to be able to detect that change?
Yeah, good points, Matt. Thanks for adding that in. I'm going to switch the example to something like desert bighorn sheep, where we know we can have a disease outbreaks in those populations.
Right.
And so if we say, hey, if the population, if I'm making numbers up here, but if a population gets below, say, 300 sheep, then we're going to do some investigation as to why a population has declined. If we have imprecise answers in our estimates, we're likely to hit that threshold a whole lot sooner than if we had a more precise estimate. Or we might get a trigger that's unnecessary because our estimate was imprecise. But if it was a more precise answer, then we could actually say, hey, no, this is more real because we have the precision assessment that's showing. There's something that has definitely happened. And we've spoken in the past, not just on this podcast, that if you want to compare look at a trend in a population over time, where you will make comparisons across populations, if your results are imprecise, right, you have a large span on your mean can be in a wider area range of values than a more precise estimate, it could be harder for you to compare to imprecise estimates because they're not going to show much difference, but it's a whole lot easier to compare more precise estimates to see if they are different or if they're the same.
Yeah, and that's a function of trying to understand how precision in both space and time to be able to get at trends, to be able to precisely detect a change in trend. Like Mike Conroy's paper, where we're looking at changes in bighorn sheep over time. What he was looking at in that was what percentage of the landscape or the number of the units should we be surveying every few years? And he looked at different survey intervals in the simulation and basically showed that it was quite difficult with fewer surveys in fewer parts of the management units being surveyed to detect significant trends based on the current survey design. You know, Grant, there's another source of variability that we really haven't discussed, and that is the variability associated with detecting an individual during a survey and how that influences and could influence us, be influenced by several different factors, your ability to capture it using the different gear types, see it, maybe environmental, but that just adds to the overall variability or sources of variability that we're sort of discussing today. We've kept it pretty simple up until this point, but when you include observation error, measurement error, it adds a different level of variability. They can also greatly influence your results.
Randy, could you maybe give a more real world example of that to explain to people what you mean?
Let's just start with, you know, a type of survey design in models that match it. I'm going to go to one that I've been working on here recently, which is with removal modeling. And removal modeling, you basically go to a population and you assume that it's closed at the beginning of the survey And then you just started removing individuals from it through multiple visits. And then through that process, you're able to estimate total population size. Not population size, but a sample-specific population size of that surveyed area. One interesting thing about detection probability is that it's not perfect. You don't see everything whenever you're surveying an area. It's never one, so to speak, because you're never able to conduct a census. However, it's oftentimes much less than one. And for our rare and endangered species, it's less than 50% oftentimes, too. And we're seeing that for some of our Rio Yaqui fishes, that it could be as low as 0.20. And you're kind of wondering, okay, well, when it's that low, how does that influence the overall results of your ability to get accurate results is what I'm going to. And accuracy is trying to get close to the bullseye, which is that true population parameter. And what I have found is that when you have variable detection, so let's say animals get harder to capture with each visit, the first visit, you remove all the naive, easier to capture individuals, and then you're left with the more difficult, trained, educated animals. With each subsequent pass, it gets harder and harder. Maybe environmental conditions also influence that. And what that can do is it can really increase your variation where your ability to accurately estimate the true number of individuals is significantly reduced. And now you got to think, okay, you have that at just the site. That's happening during the sampling process, that variability and noise that has to be minimized. And then when you think about surveying multiple locations, multiple sites, now you have site-to-site, site-specific variability and noise. And let's say you're doing it over temporal, and you're doing the same experiment at these same sites for 10 years. Now you have 10 years worth of temporal variability. And so when you have observation error, detection process, the capture process variability at the site, then you have site-specific variability from site to site is what I'm going for, and then temporal changes over time. That's a lot of variance that you have to consider when designing a survey.
Right. It could compound over time and just blow things up. When I was before we moved here to New Mexico, I was doing work in Alaska, and I was working with two guys, Don Spallinger and Tom Hanley, and the project they were working on was how much browse is available for moose in certain valleys of the Kenai Peninsula and elsewhere in coastal Alaska. And in order to get that, the method was looking at different browse species, estimating heights, width of bushes and shrubs, the length of stems, the number of stems on the plant. And each one of those had its own variability too. And so when you start putting that together, you have so much variability in how much browse, it can be meaningless. So the trick, just like you're speaking to, Randy, is how to kind of compartmentalize that variability and analyze it in a meaningful way so you can get results that actually have some sort of impact to what you're trying to answer.
So that they got me thinking about something that Warren Ballard asked me during my PhD defense. It was probably during my comps. He asked something along the lines of, let's say you're the caribou biologist in Alaska, and you're doing surveys for caribou, and you've set up this really cool survey that accounts for the detection and tries to get at relatively precise estimates of abundance and so on and so forth. And you go up and you do your survey, and you see that there's been a 35% decline from last year to this year. But the precision in your estimates are such that you can't statistically say that last year's population is any different than this year's population. What do you do? And my gut was, well, it's not statistically different, so let's not go crazy here and implement a bunch of management. And his argument was that was the wrong answer. And the reason is because if I'm wrong and there has been a 30 or 40% decline, we're not doing the resource any good by ignoring that decline and waiting for the stats to come out that it is real. So wait another year and no, now it's declining 60%. And I detect a 60% decline. I don't necessarily fully agree with the answer because I don't know about statistics that some of that can just be the stochastic noise, if you will. But we are, as resource managers, are responsible for that resource. And so if we have information pointing us towards we've got a problem, we probably better start doing something about it. If it's simply just doing some additional investigation, it might not be, you know, pull out the big guns in our management activities and do some management right away. It might simply be, oh, well, we're going to go ahead and do an additional survey or two this year so we can get better precision to know, yeah, that is a real decline, or no, it turns out it wasn't, and it's okay. And that kind of leads us to this idea, I think, of value of information. Like, what do you do when you see your result? Does it trigger anything? What are you going to do when you get a result? And a lot of times we have people, well, I'll just talk about the Whooping Crane world. When we started doing the survey, there were people that thought we should be able to detect one bird change in that population, which frankly is impossible. It's just not something that can be achieved. But even more important than that is, what does it matter? Are you going to do something if there was a one bird change? No. You're not going to change anything that you're doing in that population over a one bird change. But at some level of change, you are going to start to implement some new management action, right? So how big is that change that's going to cause you to do something? And then you need to try to build surveys in a way that actually capture that kind of change. Will tell you with certainty that, yes, that change has occurred. Now, the question then becomes, back to Warren's question for me as well, I messed up. I didn't do as well of a job at estimating abundance this year. And it looks like we had that kind of change, but I can't tell it statistically. Now, what do I do? And I'll leave you all scratching your head as to what you would do in that scenario. Do I implement the big management and try to save the population or do something to recover the population when, in fact, it may not have even declined statistically? It's a question we have to grapple with every day in wildlife sciences.
Yeah, it's all about managing risk, right, Matt? Right. Yeah. That's what you guys are talking about, is managing risk. And if it's real and you don't do anything, there could be repercussions for that. If it's not real and you do something, you may have spent a lot of money, but you're okay shape. We all know that resources are limited. So if you spend more money on something, you're not spending it on something else. Yeah, you're just managing the risk. Right, Matt?
When we started trying to prioritize our biological resources or resources concerned, one of the things we were trying to do was develop something called SMART objectives for those priorities, which is basically like setting a goal or objective that's specific, measurable, achievable, relevant, and time bound or time limited. So the acronym SMART. So basically we wanted stuff that was specific in that it wasn't just, well, we want to know something about black rails. Well, that doesn't help. What do you want to know about black rails? Well, I want to know how many there are and their trends through time. Okay, that's relatively specific. Is that measurable? Can we measure the abundance of black rails, or are we really going to be looking at occupancy? So you start to have that discussion. Is it achievable? Can we even do this, or is it logistically impossible? Is it relevant? Is it something that matters to management? Yeah, it's an endangered or threatened species, and it's something we actively manage, so it's relevant. And then, in what kind of time frame do we want to be able to detect that trend or those changes in abundance? So is that something we want to be able to see over a 1 year, over a 2 or 3 year period, or a 10-year period? So you start to put all that together to kind of define a survey or monitoring program to help feed information into a management program for a particular species.
The only thing I would add there, Matt, is in the specific, that in the S, in the SMART, the specific, I would advocate we asked folks or we asked ourselves, what are we aiming for? And, you know, we kind of invoked Mike Conroy again. We might as well bring him in again. I know we're eating burritos maybe 2 years ago with him here in Albuquerque, and he said some pretty influential stuff. One of them was, before you start doing a survey, asking yourself or asking others who are advocating for that survey or whatever study it is how is this answer going to affect what you do? How's this going to change what you do? How's it going to affect your management? How's it going to affect your decision-making? If you got this answer, what does it mean for your work? And I think that's something we all should be mindful of, is how are we going to use these results and how are we going to use that answer to make a decision on what we're doing?
Hey, Matt and Randy, I think we'll wrap up our discussion here. So until then, thank you for listening to Wattify the Numbers. We hope you enjoyed this session and maybe learned something.